cold and forced himself to stand there for 30 seconds. If he wasn't fully awake before, he definitely was now. It was like downing 3 rapid espressos. When he stepped out of the shower, he found that Lara had picked out an outfit for him. All he had told her was that he had to go to the White House. That was all she needed to know. What she chose was perfect: dark suit, white shirt, dark tie. "Is it like this every morning?" she asked, as he moved through the kitchen and kissed her. "That's the president for you," he said. "Can't live without me." She knew he wasn't serious and grabbed his ass.
"Tell him he needs to go through me from now on, or I'm not voting for him again."
Ever since he had come to the realization that he loved her, everything she did or said seemed to back it up.
"I'll tell him. Reed Carlton won't like being cut out of the loop, but he'll learn to live with it."
"Let him know he doesn't have a choice."
He smiled and kissed her again before grabbing his keys and heading for the door.
"Hey!"
she shouted from behind him. When he turned, he saw her holding up a roadie.
"Black. 2 shots of espresso."
Smiling, he crossed back over to her.
"I love you. You know that?"
he said, trying to take the cup from her.
"Wait, what did you just say?"
Shit, it had totally slipped out. He meant it, of course, but this wasn't the way he wanted to say it for the first time, not rushing out the door. It was a watershed moment. He could make it better, or he could make it worse. Setting down the mug, he took her face in his hands and said,
"I love you."
Lara was speechless. She had only truly loved one other man, her husband, and had watched him drown right before her eyes. Now here she was with this seal, whom she teasingly referred to as James Blonde, and he had just told her that he loved her. For a moment, it felt like she couldn't even breathe.
"This sucks," he said.
"No, it doesn't," she replied.
"This definitely doesn't suck.
I thought we'd at least have the morning together. I didn't think I'd be saying this and running out the door."
She looked at him.
"You were actually planning how you wanted to say that to me?"
He didn't know how to respond. Was planning to tell her a bad thing? Didn't women like when men planned? He decided to explain how he planned to do it and why, but all he could get out was,
"Yes."
Lara put her arms around his neck, pulled his lips to hers, and gave him the longest kiss they had ever shared. Then she was the one who broke it off.
"You better get going," she said.
She was smiling from ear to ear. Slapping him on his backside as he picked up his coffee, she added,
"Remember what I told you to tell the president."
All he could do was shake his head and laugh. It was another moment, another brief, wonderful moment, where nothing else existed and nothing else mattered. Then he climbed into his SUV, and the real world crowded in with him. He did the time difference in his mind, with his mother in California, as well as a former SEAL buddy of his who ran a remote fishing lodge in Alaska. It was too early to call either of them. He decided to put those phone calls on hold. It was also too early to call Ben Beeman, but that call couldn't wait. There were some things about Congo that needed sorting out. He also needed a favor, a big one. By the time Harbath rolled up to the White House security checkpoint at the West Gate, the biggest item on his personal list already had a check mark next to it. It was a good start, and with that done, he could focus on work and why the president had called him in. Pulling into one of the parking spaces near the West Wing entrance, he turned off the ignition and hung the badge he had been issued around his neck. It always felt weird coming back. He had practically lived at the White House at one point. He didn't miss the Secret Service, though. Leaving the SEALs hadn't been a mistake. He had learned a lot, met a lot of people, seen and heard some incredible things, but protecting a president had meant playing defense. That wasn't his strong suit. Offense was what he did best, finding the bad guys and taking the fight to them before they could bring the fight to us. With the SEALs and the Secret Service, he had gone through the best training the United States had to offer. Then, the old man had shown him what else was out there,
and had taken his game to a level he never before could have imagined. He had gone from being an alpha dog to an apex predator, a species that sat astride the top of the food chain with no competition. He radiated a calm, effective confidence that had nothing to do with arrogance, but rather an effective ability to handle anything that was thrown at him, no matter how fast. It was a good thing, too, because things were about to speed up dramatically. The Marine guard outside the Situation Room waved him to the blast-proof door, which was so well-engineered that it opened without any perceptible hiss of its locks releasing or any sound of its bolts sliding back. Reed Carlton was already inside, as was the President. At the long mahogany conference table were Lydia Ryan, her boss, CIA Director Bob McGee, General Ian McCollum, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Colonel Sheila White, M.D., the Director of USAMRID. Absent were any other members of the President's National Security Team. His own Chief of Staff wasn't even there. Per the old man's suggestion, he had kept this meeting highly compartmentalized. There was something in the wind, something he didn't like. Seeing those government personnel assembled at Damien's Virginia estate troubled him. It had looked like a conclave of third-tier royal functionaries, and historically, when that many functionaries assembled outside a palace, it usually meant that they were up to no good. The old man pulled out the chair next to him and waved Harvath over. Their briefing was already in progress. Sitting down next to Carlton, Harvath reached for the carafe of coffee in front of them, poured himself a cup, and listened as Colonel White spoke.
The Star Team's drone shows zero activity at the N'Goa facility. In fact, it looks completely abandoned. We're getting the same thing from the satellite. Normally, we'd conduct this kind of operation at night, but all things considered, we decided to advance the timetable. With your permission, Mr. President.
President Paul Porter nodded. He had a glass of orange juice in front of him and looked like he had been up all night. General McCollum picked up his phone and gave the command to begin the operation.
This is Wedgwood, he said. Raptor is a go.
The raid on the N'Goa facility, where the African hemorrhagic fever had allegedly been weaponized, would be coordinated by the United States Special Operations Command out of a highly secretive TOC, also known as a Tactical Operations Center, at a far corner of MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. The large, acoustically protected, darkened, raised floor room was packed with flat panel monitors, electronics, and rows of desks. On the outside of its door, there was no name, no number. None of the personnel who worked there ever spoke of it. It was a black hole from which some of the country's blackest operations were conducted. For all intents and purposes, the TOC and what happened within it didn't exist. The Situation Room back at the White House was similarly adorned with flat screens. Synced with the TOC at MacDill, each of them showcased a variety of images. In addition to the satellite and drone footage, there were feeds from the helmet cams being worn by the Star Team. A voice from the MacDill TOC came down through the Situation Room's overhead speakers.
Raptor Actual, this is Raptor Main. You are clear to commence.
Roger that, Raptor Main, said a voice from the team in Congo. Raptor is clear to commence.
Considering the distance it had traveled up the satellite and back down to the United States, the transmission was clear with almost no delay. As the team emerged from the tree line and approached the facility, Harvath set his coffee down and leaned forward. It reminded him of his own approach at the Matumeni Clinic just 6 days ago. The N'Goa facility was composed of similar one-story buildings, clustered around a sizable clearing hacked out of the jungle. Unlike Matumeni, though, N'Goa had layers of perimeter security. The first was a tall chain-link fence capped with razor wire. Harvath, the president, and everyone else watched from the safety of the Situation Room as a Star Team member cut through the fence. The rest of the team stood in the open clearing behind him, exposed. Though they were armed, they were suited up in full biohazard gear, which meant that their ability to detect and react to threats was severely impaired. In other words, they were sitting ducks. It put everyone on edge, but particularly Harvath, who knew exactly what it felt like to be in their boots at that moment. If they were spotted, it was game over. The team in the MacDill talk seemed to be reading Harvath's thoughts and called for sit reps from the two sniper teams that had been sent ahead to provide overwatch. Each team reported back that the coast was clear. Once an opening had been cut into the fence, the operator with the cutters tucked them in his pack, transitioned back to his weapon, and held the curtain of chain link open for everyone else to pass through. The operator with the handheld mine detector got back on point and led the team forward. As he had done when leading them out of the jungle, he swept the device back and forth, careful to keep his eyes peeled for tripwires or other improvised triggers. This was Congo, and Ngua wouldn't be the first time they had encountered anti-personnel devices. The other members kept in tight formation behind. The second ring of perimeter security was a concrete wall about 10 feet high. Along the top, set into the cement, were shards of glass from broken wine and beer bottles. Though inelegant, the message was clear. This facility was not open to unauthorized visitors. The team made their way to a set of large gates secured by a padlock and chain. The operator with the bolt cutters stepped forward, and after another sit rep from the snipers, the team was authorized to make entry. Once the chain was cut, the Star Team members swept into the compound in perfect coordination, their weapons up and at the ready. With all of the video feeds coming into the Situation Room, it was like trying to drink from a fire hose. Harvath kept his attention focused on the satellite imagery, only occasionally glancing at one of the helmet cams when he needed a better idea of what the team was seeing. Their primary target was the largest and most central building in the compound. Based on analysis of the reconnaissance imagery, it was deemed to be the most likely location of the laboratory. Harvath checked his watch. The Star Team had to be burning up in those suits. They had covered much more ground than he and Decker had getting to their objective, plus the temperature was higher because it was broad daylight. They weren't going to be good for much longer. Arriving at the main building, the bulk of the team formed a stack, or as it was sometimes called, a conga line, while several other members took up defensive positions outside. When everyone was in place, the team leader announced they were ready to make entry. Colonel White nodded to General McCollum, who relayed permission to the MacDill talk. With a final sweep of the structure by satellite and the sniper teams once more radioing their all clear, a voice came over the speakers in the Situation Room. "Raptor Actual," it said. "This is Raptor Main. You're good to go."
"Roger that, Raptor Main," the voice from Congo replied.
"Raptor is good to go." With that, the Star Team leader made sure his team was ready. Then, counting down from three, they breached the building and rushed inside. Chapter 37. Harvath had no idea how the patient who had escaped the Ngoa facility had gotten out. With a 10-foot-high wall and a razor wire fence, it wouldn't have been easy. Did he stow away in a vehicle? Did he have help? Did he simply walk out the back gate when no one was looking? There was no way to know. What Harvath did know was that as the crow flew, a healthy person could walk from the Ngoa facility to the Matumeni clinic in a day. This guy, though, hadn't been healthy. He was on death's doorstep the minute he arrived at Matumeni. Did he steal a bicycle? Did a good Samaritan come across him and help deliver him to the clinic? That was probably an even more important question than how he got to the clinic. Anyone he came in contact with would have been exposed to the virus. Had Hendrik and his men reverse-engineered his route? They had murdered everyone at Matumeni as well as the adjacent village to prevent the disease from spreading. What about anyone else he had come in contact with along the way? Harvath made a mental note to make sure the question got transmitted to Vela and his interrogation team at the Solarium site in Malta. Drawing his attention back to the video feeds, Harvath listened to a chorus of, "Clear! Clear!" ringing out as the Star Team secured room after room of the Ngoa facility's main building.
all of them were empty. Not only were they devoid of people, but they had been stripped clean of furniture, equipment, computers, everything. The only things left were the paint and light fixtures. Like Matoumeni, Harvath figured it had been bleach-bombed as well. In fact, as this was alleged to be ground zero for the new, highly communicable strain of African hemorrhagic fever, they had probably taken bleach-bombing to a completely new level. Based on the building's layout, there appeared to be two patient wings, likely one for men and one for women, communal bathrooms, showers, and a series of examination rooms. This wasn't where any actual experiments on the virus would have been conducted. On the far side of the compound, they discovered the lab, or at least what was left of it. The structure had been burned to the ground. All that remained was the charred hulk of some sort of walk-in freezer.
"That can't be a level 4 lab," Colonel White said. "It's too small."
Level 4 was the highest CDC-specced biocontainment safety level possible. It was reserved for the most dangerous and severely lethal pathogens researchers might come in contact with. Harvath saw something on one of the team members' helmet cams and asked McCullum to have McDill back the man up and return to where he had just been.
"What do you see?" the general asked.
"Those depressions in the ground," he replied, before looking over at Colonel White and asking, "What if the lab was mobile?"
"As in a trailer? Like the Iraqis allegedly had?"
He nodded.
"I don't know how the hell you'd move one on the roads in Congo," she stated, putting the word roads in air quotes.
"And God help you if it flipped over."
"But it could be done.
Positive pressure suits, a segregated air supply, showers, a UV light room. Building a mobile level 4 would be a ton of work, not to mention a ton of money."
Something told Harvath expense wasn't something Damien and the plenary panel worried about.
"But it could be done," he repeated.
"Seeing as how we've dropped some pretty high-tech shipping container expeditionary labs into war zones, anything is possible."
The STAR team was reaching the threshold of how long they could stay in the suits before a heat stroke began to set in. They needed to break off and get to the decontamination showers they had set up back in the jungle. Harvath had seen enough. The Ngoa facility was a bust. When Colonel White looked around the room and asked if anyone needed to see anything else, everyone shook their head. General McCollum notified the McDill TOC that the STAR team could come off station and proceed to decon. Once the team had exfiltrated the Ngoa facility and retreated into the jungle, President Porter opened the floor for discussion.
"Now what?" he asked,
excusing himself for having to remove a handkerchief from his pocket and blow his nose.
"Anyone have any ideas?"
Harvath cleared his throat and looked at Colonel White.
"How much of my debrief from Congo did you read?"
"The whole thing."
He looked over at General McCollum, who nodded and said,
"I did as well."
He knew Lydia Ryan and Bob McGee, as well as the president, had read theirs, so that meant everyone in the room was up to speed. He also knew that they had been made aware of the patients who had bled out in Chicago, Houston, and Detroit. It had been one of the reasons Colonel White had moved to push up the Ngoa operation. Harvath filled them in on what they had learned about the patients and their travel histories. He then laid out his theory about the Hajj and how the virus might have been introduced.
"What kind of protocol do we even have for something like this?" President Porter asked, fishing his handkerchief back out. "It's federal, not military," McCollum responded.
"CDC, NIH, FEMA," White added, "all coordinated from DHS.
Out of an abundance of caution, White had not been told that right now all of those organizations were suspect and were being purposefully cut out of the loop by the White House.
"Let's say something happened," CIA Director McGee replied, fixing his eyes on White, "and DHS was unable to get spun up in time. How would you want to see things unfold?"
"Why wouldn't DHS, or more importantly, FEMA or CDC or NIH, be able to respond in a timely manner?" she asked.
"Just answer my question."
"Is this a drill?"
"No," the president replied. "This isn't a drill. Please answer."
"We'd want to know as much about this strain of African hemorrhagic fever as possible.
We'd need samples. We'd need them from any newly diagnosed patients here. But if this thing did start in Congo, I'd like to get samples from there, too. Ideally, I'd want the samples taken at the Matumeni Clinic from patient zero. I'd want anything you could get from that sick rebel commander, as well as samples from that Matumeni Clinic worker and his son, who transported patient zero's samples and who was there when the rebel commander was exposed. That's just for starters.
President Porter looked at Harvath. On the Congo end of things, how doable is that list?
Provided the rebels are where we left them, I could give the STAR team coordinates and they could go in to get samples from the commander's corpse. We left him in the jungle, though, so his bones might be picked clean by now.
We'll take that chance, said Colonel White.
And the rest of it? Porter asked.
When we left Bunya with Dr. Decker, Leonce and Pepsi said they intended to stay there. There was nothing left for them in their village.
Could we find them?
I have someone who could track them down, said Harvath, thinking of Jumbo.
Which just leaves us with recovering the patient zero samples from the WHO offices in Kinshasa, stated White. Do you have somebody who could do that?
Jessica Decker was back in Kinshasa, but he didn't believe for a minute that she would cooperate, much less that she could pull it off on her own. Needless to say, he did know someone, and he nodded.
We have an experienced team in-country we can use, Harvath replied.
Extremists? Carlton asked, referring to Ash and the three other SAS men.
He nodded once more. But do they know how to handle samples? White inquired. How to package them for transport? Will they even know how to locate them in the Kinshasa office?
All good questions, the answers to which were no. Ash and his men, as far as he knew, didn't have applicable experience in handling highly lethal pathogens. He shook his head. Colonel, Porter said, how soon can you get someone from the STAR team to Kinshasa to supervise?
I can task one of them immediately, but it'll all come down to transport.
And extremists? The president asked, looking at Harvath.
Same answer.
What about samples from the U.S. patients? Said Lydia Ryan.
Normally, I'd say that wouldn't be a problem, White replied. We have a good working relationship with the CDC. With something like this, they'd want as much help as they can get. But we began this discussion with Director McGee asking me what USAMRID would do if the CDC couldn't respond.
McGee looked at the president, then at her.
Ask the CDC for the samples, just as you normally would in a situation like this. If you get any pushback, let us know, and we'll take care of it.
If this is some kind of terrorist attack, she stated, why are we not telling them?
There are additional national security issues involved, McCollum replied as he closed his briefing book. He had been read in on the full scope of the situation before White had arrived, and that was all he said. White was a highly skilled scientist, but she was also a soldier and a professional who respected the chain of command.
Understood, she responded.
After thanking General McCollum and Colonel White for their attendance, the president excused them from the Situation Room. He then turned to the remaining attendees and asked for a domestic update. Carlton and McGee gave the president a quick rundown, hitting the high points and answering the handful of questions that were raised. The longer they sat in the Situation Room, the worse the commander-in-chief looked. Are you feeling okay, Mr. President? Carlton finally asked.
I'm fine, Porter replied, coughing briefly to clear his chest.
What about those letters MC that Damien wrote in relation to their plan for the United States? Have we figured that out yet?
No, sir, McGee said. We're still working on that.
Well, work faster. I want another update in 2 hours, and by update, I mean progress. Is that understood?
Around the conference table, everyone nodded and replied, Yes, Mr. President.
As the president stood, the rest of the room stood, and Harvath pressed his luck.
Mr. President, one last thing, if I may, sir.
Porter didn't look happy, but he nodded.
Sir, Harvath continued, I know when it was originally presented, you tabled any talk of taking Damien into custody.
You mean rendering him, the president clarified.
Yes, sir.
Do you know why I tabled it?
I think I have an idea, sir.
Well, allow me to clarify it for you, Porter retorted. Pierre Damien is an American citizen currently on U.S. soil. He is also a citizen of Canada, which is an important American ally. Damien is also a diplomat, an Under-Secretary General with the United Nations, no less. He's a wealthy and powerful man with a lot of wealthy and powerful friends.
I understand, sir. It's just...
The president cut him off. Don't interrupt me. Never before had Harvath been chastised by Porter. He regretted interrupting him immediately. Any corners you may have to cut from time to time downrange, or things you may have to do in the name of expediency, become considerably more complicated when the recipient of those measures is an American citizen. Place that citizen on U.S. soil, and the complication factor skyrockets so high that God himself couldn't even reach it. Porter took a moment to catch his breath and look around the table before returning to Harvath.
Making a case is like laying bricks, and you don't have enough of them. You have the slaughter of workers at a medical clinic, and a village in a part of Africa most Americans know nothing about. It's horrific, I'll give you that. But the only thing you have tying it to Pierre Damien is the word of some mercenary whom you subjected to waterboarding and then rendered to Malta without any authorization whatsoever. That's it. That's all you have. And that means that's all I have. That's all my attorney general would have. It doesn't matter who was seen coming out of his house. He, like every other American, has a right to free association. Do I enjoy his anti-American rhetoric? No. But he also has a right to freedom of speech, along with a long list of other rights guaranteed to him in the Constitution, a document that I swore an oath to preserve, protect, and defend. So when you ask me if you can render an American citizen from American soil for a crime he allegedly orchestrated in the Democratic Republic of Congo, based upon a statement coerced from a non-U.S. citizen under unauthorized, harsh interrogation, my answer is not only no, it's hell no. Does that clarify my position for you?
Yes, Mr. President.
Paul Porter looked around the table one last time. Everyone else nodded, and with that, he exited the Situation Room. Harvath, Carlton, Ryan, and McGee sat for a moment in stunned silence until McGee said,
"That went well."
Carlton shook his head.
"You never ask a question you don't already know the answer to."
Harvath didn't want to be disrespectful to the old man, but he couldn't hold his tongue.
It needed to be asked.
"No, it didn't. At least not directly. You know better. He's the President of the United States. He doesn't mind a little coloring outside the lines, but there are certain things that you have to be very delicate about raising, and there are most definitely things that cannot be put to him point blank."
Harvath glanced at Ryan. There were times where she seemed to understand him better than either of their bosses.
"It all comes down to bricks, right?"
"What?"
"The president told you. You don't have enough bricks. He wants you to build the thickest, highest wall you can, something Damien will never be able to scale. I didn't hear POTUS say stop. I just heard him say that for the time being, you can't choke any of your bricks out of Pierre Damien directly."
Was that it? Was that what the president was telegraphing? He hadn't shut them down. He had simply established a bright line. One that for now, they would all have to abide by. Switching to strategy, they remained for a few more minutes to discuss roles and who was going to do what next. After discussing the Israelis and Ben Mordecai, they agreed to talk again in an hour and exited the Situation Room en masse. Halfway up the stairs, Harvath's phone began to blow up, chiming with a string of texts, all of them from Nicholas, telling him to call in. As he hit the exit for the West Wing, his phone sprang to life once more, this time with a call, "Atomic Dog" by George Clinton. The old man looked at him.
"Nicholas," Harvath responded.
answer it.
Chapter 38. It was a torrent of bad news.
6 more cases have been reported, said Nicholas.
Where?
Harvath replied.
San Francisco, Cedar Rapids, Atlanta, Philadelphia, New York City, and Washington, D.C.
Washington? Harvath shouldn't have been surprised. D.C. and Northern Virginia had large Muslim populations. He just hadn't expected this thing to spread so quickly, much less wind up on his own doorstep overnight. But it was there, and they were going to have to deal with it.
Has the media gotten a hold of this yet?
He asked.
Yes, replied Nicholas. And in the last 2 hours, health ministries from 11 other countries have reached out to the CDC. They're trying to control the information flow in order to prevent a panic.
Good luck with that, Harvath thought. In his experience, life was predominantly made up of 3 distinct groups: sheep, sheepdogs, and wolves. And if there was one thing he had learned from a lifetime of hunting wolves and protecting sheep, it was that sheep had 2 speeds: graze and stampede. Now that word was out that the virus was loose, all bets were off. Very soon, chaos was going to ensue.
What else do you have?
He asked, bracing himself for more bad news.
The pharmaceutical companies Damien's involved with appear pretty benign. One focuses on dementia medication, and the other on birth control drugs.
Go figure.
I think you were right about the Congolese Muslims, though, Nicholas continued. There was a group of 30. They arrived and departed Saudi Arabia via the same privately chartered aircraft.
Finally, some good news.
Any passport photos or CCTV footage?
He asked.
All of it has been transmitted to the Solarium. Vela is personally going to go through it with Hendrik.
While it wouldn't move the ball down the field, at least it would confirm his theory.
Anything else?
Mordecai's asset made contact.
The woman with Damien?
Yes, Nicholas replied. She thinks she captured his password.
That's even better news.
And it keeps getting better. The keystroke logger captured activity from multiple devices in the room, one of which we were able to ID.
Which was?
A laptop, belonging to Linda Landon from the Department of Homeland Security.
Have you reviewed all of the keystrokes they caught?
No one has seen them, not even Mordecai. Without access to secure comms, his asset isn't transmitting the data. She and Damien are having lunch today at some place called La Niçoise in Winchester. She's going to pass the actual memory card to Mordecai there.
With all the tech the Israelis had, he was a little surprised they couldn't have equipped her with some way to encrypt and transmit the data. But by the same token, this was an incredibly important operation. They were risking a ton just sending her in with a keystroke logger. There was no telling what Damien or his people might have done if they had discovered any of it. He also needed to keep in mind that Mordecai's operation had revolved around the city of Geneva, where it wouldn't have been a big deal to pass off the memory card on her way to work or to a store or something like that. Now that she was at Damien's rural Virginia estate, she was much more isolated. There was no telling how secure his Wi-Fi was and what possible digital eavesdropping measures he had in place. He was known to entertain wealthy and extremely powerful people. Did he eavesdrop on any of their communications? The restaurant was a good play. The handoff would be low-tech, old-school espionage 101. What he didn't like, though, was that they'd be burning hours in a battle where every second counted.
Where's Mordecai now? Harvath asked.
Still at the canal house. The team that's on him is about to rotate off.
Who's up next?
Sloane Ashby and Chase Palmer are back on.
Harvath put the phone on mute, spoke to the old man for a couple of seconds, and then returned to Nicholas.
How would you like to get out of this skiff for a little bit?
That depends, the little man said. What do you have in mind?
Lunch. I'll buy.
Nicholas's gray Sprinter cargo van was a rolling talk. It had satellite communications equipment hidden in the roof and was packed with racks of electronics inside. Special hand controls had been added that allowed him to drive the van himself. They arrived in downtown Winchester well before the lunch rush and found parking half a block down from L'Anissoise on the other side of the street. Its awning promised Mediterranean French cuisine, two of Nicholas's favorites. Harvath exited the van and came back 15 minutes later with Ty.
"What the hell is this?" the little man complained.
"Pad see you.
I'm not eating this."
Harvath took the container back and set it on the dashboard.
"That's it?" Nicholas asked. "No champignon sauvage? No pâté de campagne? No escargot bourguignon?"
Harvath looked in his bag from Ty Winchester.
"I guess they forgot."
He shook his head.
"Less than 50 yards from a French restaurant, and you stumble around until you find Thai food."
"Who doesn't like Thai?"
"Don't play stupid with me," Nicholas replied. "You're so much better at it."
Harvath laughed and reached inside the bag.
"That's what I love about you. You never look down on anyone."
The little man fixed him with a stare.
"Is that a short joke?"
"Maybe," he replied,
handing him a styrofoam container.
"Gourmet bison burger, rare, with caramelized onions and blue cheese."
Nicholas's stare softened into a smile.
"We good?"
Harvath asked.
"It's not gigot d'agneau," he said,
lifting the lid and admiring the sandwich,
"but I'll take it. Did you bring back anything for the boys?"
Harvath looked into the back of the van at Argos and Draco, their noses in the air, taking in the smell of all the hot food.
"Sorry, they only took cash and I came up a little."
"Don't say it,"
Nicholas smiled. Harvath smiled.
"You're lucky I found some place to get you a burger."
"Thanks."
In between bites of his food, Harvath said,
"A TV was on in the Thai place. They broke from national news for a local report about another patient who had bled out at Georgetown University Hospital."
"They'll never contain this."
"The illness or the story?"
Nicholas took a bite of his burger and let his silence speak for itself. Harvath had no doubt that reporters from coast to coast were scouring hospitals, working their sources, trying to uncover additional cases. The one thing the government had going for them, for the time being, was that all of the patients thus far had contracted the illness abroad. Harvath reached for a bottle of water as Nicholas's phone chimed. The little man picked it up, plugged in his password, and read the message. He then opened the attachment and turned the phone so that Harvath could see the image.
"Here's your escapee from the Angoa facility."
Harvath looked at the image. It appeared to be a scan of the man's passport made by the Saudis when he entered their country. His name was Yusuf Makulu, and he was 27 years old.
"Who's that from?"
he asked.
"Vela, in Malta. Hendrik has confirmed that Makulu is the man who escaped and ended up at the Matumeni clinic."
It was surreal seeing the man's face, the person Colonel White had referred to as Patient Zero. If only there were one Patient Zero and not 30.
"What happened to the rest of the pilgrims he traveled to Mecca with?" Harvath asked.
Nicholas turned the phone back around and thumbed through the rest of the brief message.
"According to Hendrik, the Ngoa staff watched them die, then dug a pit, burned the bodies, and covered it up."
"Literally and figuratively."
The little man returned his phone to the console and turned his attention back to his burger. Harvath checked his own phone for an update from Ash and his team back in Congo. An aircraft had been chartered to get them to Kinshasa. Another was sent to Bunia to retrieve the Star Team member assigned to work with them. So far, there was nothing. They ate in silence until Nicholas asked,
"If we don't get a handle on this, if this whole thing spins out of control, what's your plan?"
"It's not going to."
The little man looked at him.
"Right. But let's say it does. Let's say the wheels come completely off the bus. Do you have a plan? Where would you go? What would you do?"
Harvath nodded.
"A friend of mine from the SEALs has a place in Alaska. It's cut off, remote, very tough to get to. But that's where I'd want to ride things out. He's a strategic guy.
He's laid in a lot of supplies over the years, just in case. Doomsday prepper? He's just a smart guy. He knows store shelves may not always be stocked. He also knows that if there's ever a major disaster, the government can't and won't take care of everyone. You've seen enough since you've been in D.C. There are some good people in government, but by and large, the government looks out for itself. They spent billions making sure that if the wheels come off the bus, they've got someplace safe to go with plenty of food to eat. They're protected. You and me? Not so much. We're on our own. So that's why Alaska is my plan.
But you'd have to get there first, said Nicholas. That's a pretty long way away.
I've got that covered. What about you?
The little man looked at his two dogs and then back at Harvath.
I don't know. I never really gave it much thought until now. I never felt like I had to. I guess it would depend on where the safest place was.
And then what?
Then I would figure out how to get us all there.
Meaning you, the dogs, and Nina, said Harvath, referring to the woman in Nicholas's life.
Pretty much.
Can I be honest with you? The little man nodded. That's a shitty plan.
I know, he replied. But it's the only plan I have.
Well, we'll need to get you a new one.
Until we do, Alaska sounds good.
Don't worry, said Harvath. It's not going to come to that.
But if it does?
If it does, I'll take you with me, okay?
Nicholas smiled. Harvath was a good man, one of the only real friends he had ever had.
Thank you.
Harvath was going to make a joke about stocking up on orange hair dye so that they didn't lose Nicholas in any Alaskan snowdrifts when his phone rang. It was Palmer. Activating the call, he said,
What's up?
Look sharp. Damien and the woman are here. Chapter 39. When the two black Suburbans pulled up in front of La Niçoise, members of Damien's security team exited first. They were hard men, fit, well-trained, and obviously experienced. After looking slowly up and down the block, they opened the rear passenger door so Damien could exit, followed by Helena. He offered her his arm, and the pair entered the restaurant together. The owner rushed to greet him. They shook hands. Damien inquired after the man's family, and then handed him a leather wine tote with two perfectly chilled bottles of 1978 Domaine de la Romanée-Conti Montrachet. It was $50,000 worth of wine, and the owner, also an enophile, knew it. Damien patted him on the shoulder.
When you bring our glasses, bring one for yourself.
My goodness, the man responded, thrilled.
Thank you, Mr. Damien. That is very kind of you. Please, follow me this way. Let me show you to your table.
Damien introduced Helena, and once they were seated, the owner shuttled off to fetch his own personal wine glasses for these guests. The restaurant was housed in a tiny brick building. The tables were covered with crisp linens, and the murals on the walls evoked the Mediterranean and the south of France. The music of Stefan Grappelli poured like warm café au lait from speakers hidden somewhere nearby. If she had closed her eyes, Helena could have almost imagined she was in France. There was just one thing preventing her. The sight of the extremely pretty young woman sitting at a table with Bensi on the other side of the restaurant.
Who was she? Helena wondered. Was she a Mossad operative? Was she another one of his assets? What was she doing here? Was he trying to send her some sort of message? Had he replaced her already? But Bensi doesn't even know yet that I am leaving him, Helena thought to herself.
Are you okay, my dear? Damien asked, snapping Helena out of her obsessive reverie.
She smiled at him.
The music, the smells from the kitchen. I guess I was daydreaming for a moment that we actually were in France.
Wait until we add the Montrachet to the picture, he said with a wink.
Two bottles, though, Pierre? You're going to have to carry me home.
The older man grinned.
I have always held that bottles of wine are like breasts. Three is too many, and one is never enough.
Pierre, Helena exclaimed, blushing.
Shh, we're not the only ones here.
I don't care, he replied, reaching for her hand. His smile broadened when his fingers intertwined with hers.
You have become very special to me.
I'm sure you tell that to all of the women you whisk away to America on your private jet.
I'm serious.
So am I.
You're the first woman who didn't want anything from me.
Are you sure about that?
She asked, as she gently traced his palm with the tip of her finger.
Besides that.
I think that's the reason why you brought two bottles of wine. You want to get me drunk, so you can take advantage of me when we get home.
He gave her hand a gentle squeeze before releasing it.
Did you see what year the Montrachet is?
She shook her head. Damien looked up to signal the owner, but he was already on his way over. After setting down three glasses, the man presented the wine to Damien, and upon his approval, produced a corkscrew and carefully went to work opening the bottle. After cellaring for so long, there were a million things that could go wrong with the wine. The cork, though, was perfect, not even a hint of taint. The owner placed the cork on the table so Damien could inspect it. Once he had, he encouraged the owner to pour the first taste for himself. The man took his time, admiring the color and then savoring the aromas and bouquet. When he finally tasted it, his eyes remained closed for several moments. Upon opening them, he proclaimed,
"Absolutely amazing,"
and poured glasses for Helena and Damien. Laying his hand lightly on the bottle, he gauged its temperature. The great white wines from Burgundy drank more like reds. You didn't submerge them in a bucket of ice. Their flavors were best enjoyed between 60 and 65 degrees Fahrenheit. The Montrachet was right on the money and needed no additional assistance. Damien encouraged the owner to pour himself a proper serving, instead of just a taste, which he did. After detailing the lunch specials, he excused himself and went to check on his other customers. Damien looked at Helena and turned the bottle so she could read the label.
1978, he said.
The year I was born.
I know. That's why I chose it for our lunch today.
Raising his glass, he proposed a toast. To moderation in all things, except in love. Helena touched her glass to his. She was dumbfounded. She didn't know what to say. Did Damien just tell her that he loved her? She took a sip of her wine, buying time so she could collect her thoughts.
I have something for you, he said.
Reaching down to the outer pocket of his wine tote, he removed a velvet jewelry box the size of a salad plate. Lifting the lid, he presented it to her across the table. It was the most exquisite diamond necklace she had ever seen. It had to be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
May I? Damien asked.
Helena was speechless. All she could do was nod. Rising from his chair, Damien took the necklace from its case and walked over and stood behind her. He laid the necklace against the soft cashmere of her turtleneck sweater, the heavy central diamond coming to rest right between her breasts. She swept her hair up so he could fasten the clasp. When he was finished, he returned to his seat and once again smiled at her.
I don't know what to say.
You don't have to say anything, he replied.
Pressing the necklace against her sweater, she asked,
Is this where you went this morning? To get this for me?
Yes.
I don't understand. Why?
Does there have to be a reason?
Pierre, look at this necklace. It's gorgeous. Men don't just give jewelry like this to anybody.
You're not just anybody, he replied.
She smiled and looked at him lovingly.
Don't do this to me, Pierre.
Do what?
This,
she said, with one hand still on her necklace, the other lifting her glass.
The trips, the necklace, the wine, I don't want to get used to this.
But could you?
You have me, Pierre. You don't have to do all of this.
I like doing it.
And I like that you like doing it. But don't make it complicated, please.
Damien stared at her for several moments. When my wife died, it was a pain like nothing I had ever experienced. I swore that if I survived it, I would never allow it to happen again. And then I met you, and everything changed.
You're drunk already,
she said, winking at him. He smiled at her. You have a perfect sense of humor. Do you know that? Everything about you is perfect.
You are drunk, because I am far from perfect.
You are perfect to me. We are perfect for each other. She looked at him.
Pierre, are you proposing to me?
Damien laughed. To tell you the truth, I don't know what I'm doing. All I know is that I cannot imagine being without you. Helena reached across the table and took his hand. He held her hand tightly. Promise me, you won't leave me. It was an amazingly tender entreaty. She squeezed his hand right back and replied,
I'm not going anywhere.
They sat like two lovesick teenagers, staring into each other's eyes and laughing. Damien refilled their glasses and ordered appetizers. Between their salads and the main course, Helena said to him,
I have a confession to make.
Out of instinct, he braced. Suddenly, there was a flash of that pain that he hadn't known for decades, a taste of what he prayed wasn't to come.
What is it?
He asked.
When I told you I wasn't going anywhere?
Yes.
I wasn't being completely honest with you.
You weren't?
No. I have to go to the ladies' room.
It took a fraction of a second, but he got the joke, and his look of concern evaporated into a smile. Helena walked over to his chair, ran her fingers through his hair, and kissed him.
Thank you for this, she said. For all of this. The necklace. Everything.
He looked up and smiled at her and then watched her as she walked away to the ladies' room. She was an incredible creature. He had made the right decision bringing her. He could feel it in the deepest recesses of his heart. The security operatives followed her with their eyes only. They had no reason to accompany her to the restroom. Damien was their primary, not her. The necklace was beyond incredible. She wanted to stare at it in the mirror, but there would be time for that later. Locking the door, she pulled out her phone and took care of her business first. There were so many damn apps on her phone that it was hard to find the one she was looking for. But that was the point. If Damien or any of his people had ever picked it up, and someone probably had, there was nothing unusual about any of it, not even the banking apps. In fact, she had noticed a story in one of Damien's financial newspapers one morning and had made a throwaway comment about what she thought a certain Eastern European country might do if Russia cut off its natural gas supply. She finished with her opinion on how it might affect the markets. It had impressed him. When he asked how she had come to such an erudite conclusion, she took the opportunity to tease him, explaining that she had dated a British investment banker for a while. The thought of her with another man drove him crazy and only made him want her more. All she had done was set the table. It was Damien who sat down and gorged himself on her. Finding and opening the app she wanted, she placed her bets. This would turn out to either be the smartest thing she had ever done or the most foolish. She would know soon enough, and she consoled herself with the knowledge that as bad as things might get, she had lived through worse, much worse, and it had only made her stronger. Closing the app and tucking the phone back in her purse, she removed a tube of lipstick and a small travel pack of tissues. Unscrewing the false bottom of her lipstick, she removed the tiny memory card from its hiding spot and placed it between her teeth. Peeling off the sticker that held the tissue package closed, she placed the memory card in the center and then reached down
and stuck it under the vanity, behind the sink. Bensie's little blonde was going to have to work to find it, but Helena couldn't have cared less. She had completed her assignment. The Mossad would have Damien's damn password. Once it was confirmed, they would give her their file on Enoch, and she would simply disappear. At some point, she would take her revenge on the man who had been responsible for stealing her away from her family and subjecting her to so many unspeakable horrors. There was always the possibility that the Mossad would try to double-cross her, but not Bensie. She knew him well enough to know that he would honor his promise. He was a man of his word, if nothing else. Standing in front of the mirror, she applied fresh lipstick and fixed her hair. The necklace was amazing. She would find a buyer for it somewhere in Central or South America at some point. There was no rush. She had nothing but time. Smiling at her reflection, she decided to leave Bensie a note and pressed her lips up against the mirror and left a lipstick kiss. He was going to be upset at her leaving. No one left the service of the Mossad without being granted permission, but it would go deeper than that with Bensie. He would take it personally. It would be an affront to him like having a weekend guest who never sent you a thank you note. His problem was that he had always seen himself as her savior. In the beginning, that's how she had seen him too. In fact, to such a degree that she had fallen in love with him. But as time wore on and he sent her on assignment after assignment, making it perfectly clear the lengths he expected her to go for Israel, her feelings for him shifted. She had traded one jailer for another. As a sex slave, she had been physically abused and threatened with death. As Bensie's asset, she had been psychologically abused and threatened with prison. Like her desperate hope that the pimps would eventually stop and let her go free, she had grown to begin hoping the same thing under Bensie. And then, she finally realized that she would have to facilitate her own escape. Bensie's anger at her leaving would be his own problem. He had more than gotten his money's worth out of her. She was ready to disappear. She had put all the pieces in place. He had taught her well, and now the student was preparing the final lesson. Trail after trail would end in dark alleys and dead-end streets. Bensie and the Mossad could spend the next 20 years looking, and they would never find her. Considering all she had done for them and all that she knew, she hoped that they wouldn't come looking. They owed her that much. They owed it to her to leave her alone. There were other girls out there, younger, worse off. Replacing her wouldn't be a problem. Adjusting her sweater, Helena opened the door and exited the ladies' room. She only had to keep Damien happy for a little while longer. As soon as she had everything she needed, her new life could begin. And once that new life began, the only thing that would matter would be what she needed. Chapter 40. Ben Mordecai paid the check while Sloane Ashby was in the ladies' room. When she returned, they left the restaurant together. It had pained him to see Helena with Damien like that. She really was in love with him, and he was head over heels in love with her. No one was that good of an actress. Even from across the room, the necklace was amazing, and Mordecai questioned not only where he had lost control of this operation, but of her. Making matters worse, there was a front moving in. Though it was bright and sunny outside, he could feel it in his hands. As they stepped outside, a cold burst of wind blew a rumble of fallen leaves down the sidewalk. Mordecai turned up the collar of his coat and kept pace with Ashby back to their car. She didn't talk much, except during the meal, where it had been important for them to appear as two colleagues out having lunch. When Damien's security men had checked the room, their eyes had fallen on Mordecai and stayed there a beat longer than they had on anyone else. Then they had moved on. He had assessed them, too, the cut and fabric of their suits, the shoes, the haircuts, even their eyes, jawlines, and facial structures. They were good-sized men, all over 6 feet tall, and they appeared European, Western European, probably, definitely not Eastern European or Israeli. The world was changing so fast, though, that it was getting harder for Mordecai to tell anymore. The takeaway was that the men were disciplined and carried themselves with military bearing. With the kind of money Damien had to spend, they were likely former soldiers who had seen combat in multiple war zones, not men to be trifled with or underestimated. "She's quite lovely," Ashby said as they neared their vehicle. "Who?" Mordecai replied, lost in his own thoughts.
"Helena."
He nodded, not sure how to reply. It was an uncomfortable situation he found himself in. He wasn't exactly their prisoner. Deputy CIA Director Ryan had made that clear. But he also wasn't free to go. He either cooperated fully or they would eject him from the country, along with a handful of Israeli intelligence agents known to the CIA to be operating out of Israel's embassy. Mordecai had no choice but to comply. Hopefully, he now had what he needed and would be able to part ways with the Americans. Per their agreement, though, the Americans would get to copy the memory card before turning it over to him. When they got into the car, Ashby unlocked her phone and swiped to the picture she had taken of the lipstick kiss on the bathroom mirror.
"I think she left this for you."
Handing him the phone, Ashby put the car in gear and pulled out into the street. As they drove, Mordecai didn't speak. Their destination was an area several minutes north called Rutherford Crossing. It was a commercial shopping area with several big-box retailers and plenty of parking. Two surveillance teams had stayed behind to keep an eye on Damien. By the time Ashby pulled into the lot near the home improvement store, Nicholas and Harvath were already there. Chase Palmer arrived a couple of minutes later.
"Do you want us to join you?" Ashby asked.
"Just Mr. Mordecai," Harvath replied. "You and Chase stay out here."
She nodded and handed him the memory card she had recovered from beneath the sink of the ladies' room at La Niçoise. Mordecai stepped out of the car and followed Harvath over to the van.
"Do you like dogs?"
Harvath asked as he reached for the handle.
"I don't really have a problem with..."
"Jesus!"
he exclaimed upon seeing Argos and Draco sitting inside. When he looked up and saw Nicholas, he added,
"Son of a..."
But Nicholas cut him off.
"Not two sentences you want to be putting together."
"You..."
The little man smiled.
"Me."
"So, this is why we haven't been able to find you," said Mordecai. "The Americans have been hiding you."
"First of all, I didn't know the Mossad was looking for me. Second of..."
"Like hell you didn't. It was you who tipped the Emiratis about the Mahmoud al-Mabou operation."
Harvath looked at Nicholas.
"You two know each other?"
"Only by reputation."
"Al-Mabou? Wasn't he the founder of Hamas's military?